if they intend to hit click give, please try to do that during maybe an off-peak traffic time for our server.
Problems with charitable giving options for early filers of PFD applications. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 4th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a stunner at the U.S. Cross Country Ski Championships in Anchorage.
At first I was like, wow, I'm feeling really good. My equipment's really good. These Salomon skis are ripping.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
Alaskans filing their permanent fund dividend applications in the first day or so of the new year were frustrated by technical problems with the Pick-Click-Give program. The program allows residents to choose an Alaskan nonprofit organization to donate all or part of their permanent fund dividend to. The idea is to make it easier for Alaskans to give, but right now it's not so easy. Permanent Fund Division Director Deborah Bitney says initially there were problems on the site that did not allow people to choose the Pick-Click-Give program at all. Those, she says, were fixed right away, but there are lingering woes with the system timing out before it accesses the list of organizations to choose from.
That is an issue that I haven't received any more reports about today. We fixed all the technical issues that we were aware of. So we're encouraging people to go ahead and file their application online. And if they intend to hit click give, please try to do that during maybe an off-peak traffic time for our server.
Bitney says there are 365 eligible nonprofits this year, and the size of the list could be part of the slowdown. Bitney says right now it's an intermittent problem.
Not everyone who tried it had that experience. Many people were able to file their Pick-Click-Give very successfully. So it is a random type of an issue.
Bitney says the division is working on a process for people who have filed their PFD applications but still want to give a chance to go back and do so. That, she says, should be complete within 2 weeks. It's not known how many Alaskans may have tried to give and were not able to. Last year was the first year, and 5,100 Alaskans pledged more than $500,000 to the organization of their choice through Pick-Click-Give. The Rasmussen Foundation donated $900,000 over 3 years to help get the program going, with a major portion of the money provided in the first year to build the system. The foundation is in the second year of providing those funds. Keegan Randall was on top of the podium again today at the U.S. Cross Country Ski Championships in Anchorage. Randall won the 10-kilometer skate race. Another Anchorage skier, James Southam, took third in the men's 15-kilometer skate. Chris Freeman of New Hampshire won that race, capturing his 13th national title. There was a surprise on the podium, too. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
You couldn't find a bigger smile at Kincaid than the one plastered on Tad Elliott's face. The Durango, Colorado skier wasn't considered much of a contender. He says he was hoping for a top 10, but even that seemed out of reach. Then he started skiing.
Yeah, at first I was like, wow, I'm feeling really good. My equipment's really good. These Salomon skis are ripping. And then on the third lap, my final lap, they said, you're in second overall right now, out of everybody. And I was just like, oh my goodness. And so that motivated me to try to finish as fast as I could.
Elliott maintained the silver medal, edging out Olympic hopeful James Southam with Alaska Pacific University. Southam was a bit frustrated with the race.
It was okay. It started out really well and kind of blew up the last two-thirds of the race. I just started pretty aggressively and maybe a little too aggressively, and then just wheels came off.
It was a relatively warm day at Kincaid, about 25 degrees, and Southam says that affected the course.
The conditions were a little different than I thought they would be. Usually it's a little bit faster and a little bit firmer, and today it was a little bit softer and sugary, which when you go out fast like I did, those kind of conditions can come and bite you. And today bit pretty hard.
The women's race followed the men's event.
Alaska, this is Keegan Randall.
It was a staggered start, with skiers shuffling up to the gate every 30 seconds.
Keegan Randall, truly one of the best skiers in the world. She's won a World Cup in Rybinsk, Russia. And just recently, she was seventh place in a World Cup in Davos. And there she goes.
A crowd of fans cheered as Keegan Randall powered out of the chute and disappeared into the woods. In the end, Randall won by a comfortable 10 seconds, but she was behind several skiers at the midway point of the race.
I was getting splits around the 6 or 7K mark that I was still down by at least 5 seconds, so I really just focused and tried to, like I said, dance on my feet out there and really found my racing speed that last couple K.
Randall says she intentionally held back a little bit at the beginning.
I got advice from the boys today. They said, you know, just ski really even laps and build into it, because this course is deceivingly hard. If you go out just a little too fast, it sucks your energy and then you're really in trouble in the last bit. So I knew that if I felt strong going into the second lap, I could make up a deficit. I could do a lot. So I think it was a good strategy today.
Randall is assured a place on the Olympic team, but second place finisher Caitlin Compton of Minneapolis is hoping her race today will help gain her a spot. She says she loves skiing in Alaska and always seems to have a good race at Kincaid.
It was amazing. I woke up this morning and you know, there's just sometimes when you know it's gonna be a good day, and I kind of had that feeling like, oh, this could be a good day. So it was definitely everything that I had hoped for today.
That's the kind of thing John Farah likes to hear. The United States Nordic director looked pleased as he watched the action in the Kincaid Stadium. He says he has one hope for the event.
Everybody walks away going, hey, I threw my best race down, and that's what you want. People coming from all over the country and can say, today was a great day, and I did the best I could. Right. So no crashes, no moose, you know, no moose in front of them.
Farah says there haven't been any moose problems on the course so far this year. The cross-country ski championships include 2 more days of racing at Kincaid this week. The distance classic race is Wednesday, and the classic sprint is Friday. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
4-time champion Jeff King has made a large donation to increase the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race purse. King, a 54-year-old musher from Denali Park, is donating $50,000 to the race. The move comes after a loss of about $1 million in sponsorship money forced a drastic reduction in this year's purse. Lee Larson, president of the Iditarod Trail Committee Board of Directors, says he hopes King's example will encourage others to contribute what they can to restore the purse. Race organizers announced last month that the purse would be cut by $100,000 to about $525,000, $400,000 less than it was just 2 years ago. 75 mushers have signed up for the 1,000-mile race from Anchorage to Nome. The race begins the first weekend in March. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, solving a mystery in Seymour Canal.
We want to know, why are the krill there? Why are the whales there? And why are the other birds and animals there feeding on the krill?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
A dispute is brewing in South Central Alaska over state wildlife management, and an upcoming Board of Game Anchorage Advisory Committee vote could tip the balance one way or another. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
8 seats on the Anchorage Fish and Game Citizen Advisory Committee are up for re-election, and 2 groups are vying to gain a majority on the panel. Hunters and professional hunting guides are facing off against advocates for non-consumptive uses of the state's wildlife resources. Wade Willis is a former state and federal wildlife biologist, now heading his own web-based consulting company. He says the composition of the advisory committee needs to be more diverse.
These committees set wildlife policy, and they advise the Board of Game. We're trying to bring, you know, just a balance on that board. Most of the AC committees are strictly hunters and folks that are consumptive users. And we're just wanting to be sure that we have a good representation on the board. It's not a hunting, anti-hunting kind of setup. We're just looking for folks who can represent the needs and concerns of tourism industry or wildlife viewers, hikers.
Willis says the advisory committee can only directly manage cow moose hunts, but otherwise the Board of Game takes the AC's advice seriously. Willis is backing AC candidates who will support a slate of proposals, among them an expansion of Denali wolf buffer zones and a ban on wolverine trapping in Chugach State Park.
And these conibear traps that were being used to kill wolverines were very efficient dog killers as well. So in areas where you have multiple use, there are not only biological reasons, but social reasons why you might not prefer to have wolverine trapping in a particular area. You know, and wolverines are highly cherished by photographers and wildlife viewers and other things. So there should be areas that they have access to these animals.
Willis is currently a member of the Anchorage AC. There are 15 members on the Anchorage AC, which is one of 18 such panels in the state's South Central region. The South Central region stretches from Homer to the Wrangell Mountains. Because AC voting is open to any resident of the South Central region, residents of the Matanuska Valley are allowed to vote in the Anchorage AC election. Dane Crowley is a Palmer resident and is the new executive director of Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife Alaska chapter. He's rallying Valley supporters to vote for 8 candidates that SFW is backing.
We feel that having folks who hunt and fish and trap and participate in that are probably better likely to represent other people who hunt, fish, and trap. And I think there's been a lot of contention here in the past few years with folks who are non-consumptive users getting onto the advisory committees and putting forth proposals that are basically not in line with the mission statement of Fish and Game, not in line with the mission statement of the Board of Game.
Crowley says the ACs help shape Board of Game policy and allocation, and Anchorage's AC has more weight than, say, a committee from a less populated area. So this is an important election.
To have someone who advocates to end hunting, fishing, or trapping on an advisory committee is certainly, they represent other folks who feel that way, but the mission of Fish and Game is to provide for the maximum sustained yield for the benefit of Alaskans, and a big part of that is hunting, fishing, and trapping.
SFW's slate of 8 candidates more than matches the 7 conservation community candidates. According to Willis, changing state predator control policies is at the heart of the conservation vote's agenda. Crowley says the hunter-non-hunter dispute over wildlife management can be difficult for both sides, but the state AC system is still the best process he's seen. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
2010 is a census year, and the national count will get an early start later this month in Alaska. Ingrid Zaruba with the State Department of Labor says Census Bureau Director Robert Groves will lead a delegation of federal and state officials to the Northwest Alaska village of Norvik later this month.
To kick off the census in Norvik. The census starts January 25th. Norvik is getting ready for this celebration. They're looking forward to having the officials there.
Norvik was selected as ground zero for the 2010 census from several villages that expressed interest. Zaruba says the census always gets an early start in rural Alaska.
Due to the seasonality of Alaska residents and particularly Alaska Natives, who during spring breakup may move to fish camps. So to ensure that all people are counted and counted at their home of residence, they've started the census earlier to prevent people not being counted.
Census forms are only delivered to people's home addresses. The census begins in Alaska's road system communities and around the rest of the country April 1st, when questionnaires go out to residences confirmed through a survey.
The Census Bureau has done extensive field work for the past 2 years to check housing units, to create address listings. So whether people live off the road system and still in remote areas, or if field workers have to go in by boat or by airplane, they have spent most of last spring, field operators were out doing the last of the address listing to ensure that all housing units are accounted for and that the residents will be counted at their usual home of residence.
Zaruba says anyone who doesn't get their mail at home, including the many Alaskans who receive mail at post office boxes, will be hand-delivered a form by a census worker this spring.
Field representatives will be out leaving a census form on the doorknob if you're not home, and then asking you to mail it back in. And if they have not received it, then they will make another home visit to ensure that they pick up the form from you.
About 2,000 Alaskans will be hired by the Census Bureau to conduct the operation. Zaruba says their work will include counting people who don't have residences.
People who are homeless or who are at shelters, and that the Fairbanks North Star Borough in particular has put a lot of effort into making sure that people are counted and that they do get the forms, and that if they need assistance, that there will be people there that can help them to understand what the questionnaire says.
Fairbanks Borough Economic Development Specialist Catherine Dodge is among those working the census. Dodge says federal grants are helping to fund outreach for hard-to-count population groups like the homeless.
To do things like buy blankets and hats for the homeless. And they say Census 2010, we're going to be passing them out in January, so that we hope that they'll still be around and reminding the homeless that in March 29th, they need to come to a homeless connect that we're putting together at Pioneer Park to help count the homeless.
Dodge says grants will also pay for a range of advertising to ensure everyone is counted. The funding covers Census 2010 ice sculptures and other unique outreach efforts.
Hockey pucks for UAF hockey games. Ends up that 18 to 24-year-old males are the hardest to reach population, so we have a committee that actually has that as a goal, and we're working to find ways to connect with them and give them stuff that will remind them to be counted April 1st.
Dodge says the census money count is very important because it's used to allocate state and federal money. The census also determines how seats in the U.S. House of Representatives are apportioned.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Communication Systems, connecting your business and employees to the world through their high-capacity data network, bandwidth speeds up to 1,000 megabits per second, acsalaska.com.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
It was quite a year just passed for the Alaska Marine Conservation Council, a nonprofit group that works for the health of the oceans, small boat fishermen, and the communities they live in. In midsummer, it was revealed that AMCC was the victim of embezzlement. Dave Kubiak, a Kodiak fisherman, is the chairman of AMCC.
It came as a shock to us when one of our senior staff members discovered, you know, that someone had been using, she didn't know what extent at that point, but had been using the credit cards, unauthorized credit cards, and had been dipping into the petty cash pretty regularly. And of course, this guy was functioning as our bookkeeper. So it was a case of a fox in a chicken coop.
Accused of the embezzlement is 36-year-old Travis Robinson of Anchorage. He remains at large. Kubiak says between $80,000 and $110,000 was charged on company credit cards and taken from petty cash. He says it's been a struggle for the small organization to get the charges reversed through the credit card companies, and speculates that even if the perpetrator were brought to justice, AMCC will never recover all of the losses. Kubiak says the entire staff had to be furloughed while volunteers filled in. He says contributors and supporters have helped sustain the organization in the aftermath of the ordeal.
People came forward with their checkbooks. One of the big funders came up with like $40,000 interim to help us through, and they've been very understanding. And then we also had another organization review our bookkeeping procedures to make sure this kind of thing will never happen again.
For 2010, Kelly Harrell will take over from Dorothy Childers as the executive director. Kubiak says Childers is happy to return to the program director position she had before taking over as interim director in May. Changes in command is just one of many items on AMCC's agenda for the new year.
Well, we'll continue to work on the Tanner Crab bycatch issue locally. Dorothy Childers will be continuing to work with the Bering Sea tribes. Dan Strickland will continue to work with Bristol Bay fishermen in regard to the potential oil impact situation there. We need to flesh out, I think, if I'm not mistaken, with the council and the state, how the outside 3 miles jig season will operate. We need to come up with some management scenario for that. So there's lots of things to do.
Kubiak says AMCC will continue to work on building awareness of ocean acidification and other environmental threats to the marine ecosystem and fishing.
We have such a small vote in the big picture, but when it comes to the big picture, we're one of the first impacted because colder water holds more dissolved gas than warm water, which is why our fisheries are so rich. Our fisheries are much richer with huge school populations, unlike the southern oceans, I mean, unless you go way south and get back into cold water again. And it's because of dissolved gases, because of dissolved oxygen and carbon dioxide and so on and so forth, which can feed the nutrient levels. So we're the first, we're the ones who see it.
The Alaska Marine Conservation Council is based in Anchorage, but has board members in coastal Alaska from Petersburg to Dillingham. Most of Southeast Alaska's humpback whale population is headed south to Hawaii by this time of year, but each year more than 100 of the animals gather in northern Southeast Seymour Canal before they make their long journey to the breeding grounds. Throughout the fall and early winter, the large group of humpbacks can be found in that narrow body of water, feasting on a massive buildup of krill. The late season interaction between these huge predators and tiny prey is the focus of ongoing research. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
This is the sound of a single male humpback singing in late November in Seymour Canal off Admiralty Island. Scientists typically associate this type of song with mating behavior on the breeding grounds in Hawaii, but this particular animal was one of more than 100 that stayed late in Seymour Canal to feed on krill. Petersburg charter operator and former commercial fisherman Dennis Rogers has observed and helped scientists document this late season behavior for years.
The main attraction there is a gathering of humpback whales that congregate in Seymour Canal prior to their migration to Hawaii. And the numbers are quite astounding. It's a spectacular sight to see 150 to 200 whales in there that we document every year for the past 5 or 6 years.
In late November, scientists with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Auk Bay Lab chartered Rogers' vessel, the Alaska Adventurer, for a 10-day research trip to Seymour Canal. According to NOAA biologist John Moran, the study is focused mainly on the whale's prey, a massive buildup of krill or euphausids, tiny shrimp-like zooplankton.
We want to know why are the krill there, why are the whales there, and why are the other birds and animals there feeding on the krill? You know, is it an oceanographic event? Are they? Is it a super productive area to feed for krill? You know, are the krill being forced in there by these strong southerlies in the fall out of Frederickstown and concentrated there? So those are the questions we're trying to answer.
Moran says during the trip, the scientists counted a total of about 240 humpbacks from Seymour Canal to Juneau. He says they were surprised to see a lot of the whale surface feeding on the krill.
Typically, the krill avoid the light, and they stay down in the deep layer during the daylight hours. But on this last trip, the krill were on the surface, lots of birds feeding on krill, and the whales are on the surface. They're doing this behavior, it's called flick feeding, where they kind of slap their tails in the water and create a wall of bubbles and spiral in, similar to their bubble net feeding they do with bubbles, and kind of come up through the center of the krill after they concentrate them. And and concentrate their prey that way. So it's a really neat behavior to see a lot of activity on the surface.
The whales feed little in Hawaii, so Moran says the krill feed at Seymour is probably one of these humpbacks' last fuel-up stops before they head south. Moran says the researchers are looking at how much energy, caloric value, the krill provides for the animals.
We're trying to figure out how much does the whale need to eat, and is it, you know, is right now the krill, if they're at their peak energy content, maybe that's the best time to eat krill. You get your most bang for your buck if you're a whale feeding on fat krill rather than, you know, waiting to feed in the early spring when they're less energetic.
According to Moran, there has not been a lot of wintertime research on krill, and it ties in with broader issues beyond the conditions in Seymour.
You know, with things like ocean acidification coming up, you know, krill are a pretty important species that may be affected by ocean acidification, and it's good to get some baseline data on the krill before changes occur. And with whales, you know, the whale populations and humpback whales are increasing at, you know, 5 to 7% now. So their populations is going through the roof. And, you know, what's going to happen when they max out at their carrying capacity? You know, how what kind of changes are going to happen? So, yeah, everything's kind of happening all at once, and we want to, you know, get a handle on it before things change.
The NOAA scientists have been working in collaboration with independent whale biologist Jan Straley of Sitka. Straley started her career in Seymour Canal 30 years ago, and her research is focused on fall and winter humpbacks. She says it's a key time of year for the animals.
The fall and winter is a time when a lot of these animals, especially humpback whales, are feeding because they don't feed or hardly feed at all on the breeding grounds. So they need all their energy that they need to sustain two oceanic migrations, and their time on the winter breeding grounds needs to happen in Alaska on the colder productive waters or the higher latitudes. So they need to get everything that they are going to be taken with them to sustain themselves through the winter breeding season.
While some humpbacks, like those in Seymour, seem to stay later into the fall and early winter than others, Straley says most do eventually migrate south. She says they can make it to Hawaii within a month. Over her long career, Straley says she's only identified about 10 animals that truly stayed in Alaska for the entire winter. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Connect with Alaska businesses seeking qualified Alaskans for hundreds of jobs in oil and gas, healthcare, and dozens of other career fields by visiting Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. When you register at alexsys.alaska.gov, your experience and qualifications will be matched with real-time job postings from Alaska employers. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.